This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last week's attack on the offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris prompted an outpouring of support from comedians and satirists and humorists from around the world.
Our hearts are with the staff of Charlie Hebdo and their families tonight. I know very few people go into comedy, as an act of courage, mainly because it shouldn't have to be that.
So it is very important tonight that I express that everybody who works at our comedy show, and believe it or not, this is a comedy show, that's what we're trying to do here, all of us are terribly sad for the families of those victims, for the people of France, and for anyone in the world tonight who now has to think twice before making a joke.
Joe Randazzo, former editor of America's fake news source, The Onion, responded with an op-ed on MSNBC about the vital role that humor plays in free speech. Satire must always accompany any free society, he wrote. It is an absolute necessity. Even in the most repressive medieval kingdoms, they understood the need for the court jester. But what is it that sets satire apart from other forms of humor? Does it have to be funny? And is there a difference between clever satire and outright provocation when it comes to challenging the powerful? Again, Joe is a comedian, writer, and former editor of The Onion. I spoke with him on Friday about the careful craft of satire. Here's that conversation. Joe, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, you worked at The Onion between 2006 and 2012. What was your initial response when you heard the news of the massacre at the Paris headquarters of Charlie Hebdo?
Well, insofar as one's able from across the ocean to feel a connection to it, I sort of did, because they were stormed during their editorial meeting, and that's something that we did all the time at The Onion, that they continue to do all the time at The Onion, and that journalists and news organizations and publications do every week everywhere. And because it was satirists and cartoonists, it felt as though a lot of the work that I've done, some of my closest friends and colleagues have done and continue to do, and a lot of the ideas that I hold dear were literally murdered that day, and it definitely hurt.
Well, you know, in America, a lot of news sources were saying Charlie Hebdo, it's like The Onion. You know, it's a satirical newspaper, certainly, but satire does come in many different forms. In your mind, what distinguishes Charlie Hebdo from America's satirical giants like The Onion, The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, or even South Park?
I think the thing that differs from place to place and culture to culture is context. France has its own very proud tradition of satirizing politicians, of satirizing people in power, and a very, very proud and seriously taken tradition of secularism. So a lot of the response to the cartoons themselves, even hours after it had happened, which I think is fine and understandable, was a discussion over, were these cartoons racist? Were they inflammatory? Are they offensive? And I think it's hard for me to make a judgment on that and what Charlie Hebdo's role is in society, in French society, because it's a context that I'm not completely familiar or used to. It seems that they were very, very interested in pushing boundaries always and actively inflaming. Mm-hmm. You know, the editor of Charlie Hebdo had been quoted as saying, Muhammad's not sacred to me. You know, I don't care what people think. And, you know, I know it's been mentioned a lot lately, but they were firebombed in 2011.
Right.
That would have shut down most organizations.
Yeah. Well, you've opened up so many things. I mean, the firebombing of Charlie Hebdo and it being targeted by extremist groups in the past, that never happened to The Onion. And I wonder if there is a kind of a sanction or safety in being in print. You know, why do cartoons elicit such a much stronger response?
Well, there's something raw about caricature that I think also taps into a lot of our fears about the other and our history of racism. You know, you think about depictions of hooked-nosed Jews or black men and women, which were depicted in a cartoon caricature form, which we really do not do in the U.S. anymore. And I think that there's just something visceral about seeing those that makes it less subtle, for sure. And there's also, and I don't really have empirical evidence for this, but I think the idea of political correctness has not exactly settled on Western Europe as much as it has here in America. And I think that's something that, for good or ill, has fundamentally changed our society here in America, and in a way that I don't think it has in France. And, you know, they have their own issues there with Islamophobia and immigration issues. While we certainly have racial tensions here, it's different.
I'm going to go back to that kind of idea that there are different things that Americans would find funny or politically correct. You know, a lot of Americans might look at the Charlie Hebdo covers of a Muslim and an Orthodox Jew kissing each other passionately, slobberingly, other kinds of images that we look at in America and may not find necessarily even funny. Does satire have to be funny, Joe?
No, it doesn't. I mean, some of the greatest satire is more absurd or sad or sickening than it is necessarily funny. I think it should run the entire gamut and can run the entire gamut, but it does not have to tickle your funny bone to necessarily be effective.
So what is the difference here? You know, Charlie Hebdo has been accused of provocation for provocation's sake. How about The Onion? When you were talking things over, was there this aim to offend?
What I think a satirist tries to do is aim at the right target. And that usually means making sure that victims or powerless or the dispossessed are never at the butt of a joke, that you're aiming your joke at those in power. But I also think there's something very legitimate in inflaming for the sake of inflammation if the ideology that you're inflaming is ignorant or, for lack of a better word, stupid. And this is in no way to say that the ideology of Islam as a whole is stupid, but a belief in a system that promotes violence for the depiction of an individual is very much at odds with a modern society. There's not a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did it at The Onion. You know, in America, it's much easier and common for satirists to take aim at right-wing white people. So I remember we wrote an op-ed in the voice of Rush Limbaugh after the Haiti earthquake, in which he had said some horrible thing about Haitians, and we were all very angry about the insensitivity and his continued insensitivity. And we wrote an op-ed in which he basically called himself a monster, and, you know, it was written by him and saying that he didn't want to live anymore and didn't have the courage to off himself, and would someone please do it?
Mm-hmm.
And we were concerned that we would be sued. We weren't concerned that we would be shot. But we did it for the sake of inflammation, because the ideas that he was spouting we found so offensive that we wanted to needle those and push those.
What was the reaction to that Rush Limbaugh piece in The Onion?
Well, we never heard anything from Rush Limbaugh, so it was a little bit of relief and it was a little bit of disappointment. I doubt he ever saw it.
I'd love for you to walk us through that kind of process of editorial meetings at The Onion. You know, were there things that you discuss that as an editorial team you just thought, you know, no way, we can't do that? I mean, were there sacred cows, I guess?
There's no sacred cow in a general sense. That's a form of self-censorship that I think is deadly. But it's, you know, it's again the idea of what is the point you're making? The example that I like to use, because it's the clearest in my mind, is we had written a headline and written an article all the way through about, you know, when the Iraq War was sort of in its height and worst, mm-hmm. About a soldier who was fretting all the time that he just knows he's going to be the 4,000th fatality. And we went all the way through the process and we were going to print it. And then it occurred to us that while we felt the satire was solid there, that war and the deaths of American troops had become so commonplace as to be almost banal at this point, we realized that there was going to be a 4,000th fatality. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, our joke would retroactively have been at the expense of an individual who was serving his country. And we thought, well, there's no way we can run this. It's once that 4,000th fatality happens, this joke becomes all wrong.
Since the attack on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine in Paris this week, we've been hearing a lot of comparisons with The Onion. We're talking with Joe Randazzo. He's the former editor of The Onion. He's talking with us a little bit about their editorial process and the vitality of satire. Yeah, so it suddenly became personal. Any other topics that you just couldn't touch?
I mean, there's always going to be topics that are sensitive and that are sensitive to the staff as a whole. And we didn't always agree either mm-hmm. on, you know, people did not always agree on what was published. You know, for instance, when the Jerry Sandusky thing came out, you know, there was a lot of sensitivity around re-victimizing the victims or in any way, you know, injuring further that community that was struggling so much with what was going on there. That was almost unbelievably horrible, but all the jokes that The Onion published during that time were at the expense of either Sandusky himself or the power structure that enabled him to keep committing those crimes.
Were you or anyone at The Onion ever threatened while you were there?
Well, there would always be the occasional angry email. We would sometimes get handwritten mail too, usually, but in some sort of weird chicken scratch. Most of these came more from people who I would describe as espousing a kind of right-wing Christian ideology. There's only one time that I, in particular, was threatened, and I happened to answer the phone, and it was somebody who was complaining about an article that we wrote. I don't even recall the exact joke, but it was in support, essentially, of marriage equality. And ridiculing those who were against it. And, you know, he had promised and offered to sodomize me, which I turned down his offer. But he also threatened to, you know, kill my family and all of that. And it actually, once it got to that point, became very scary. And he had called up a few other people randomly at Onion offices and made similar threats and offers. And we did wind up calling the police, but they essentially said, well, there's nothing that we can really do. Mm. So,
what do you think the effect of this attack will be on satire? Emboldening, chilling effect?
Well, I think there's bound to be an initial sort of chilling effect. There's fear, there's anger, there's grief. But the people who committed these acts have really already lost this war of ideas and this proves it. It's this a violent and cowardly last resort lashing out against a world that's moving on. And I think this is going to definitely embolden satire. You know, I mean, you think about for all of the talk about the dangers posed by printing images of Muhammad, and you would wonder, well, what is the worst that could happen? And this was it. We've just seen the worst that can happen, and we're going to move on. And a free society has to be able to embrace all ideas, and we will continue to do that. I think hopefully we'll also open up a conversation about Westerners' views of Islamists and Islamic radicals and moderate Muslims and how these depictions may have inflamed people, and continue to talk about how we can have a pluralistic society. But in no way is it going to chill satire. It's only going to make it stronger.
Joe Randazzo, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Randazzo, he's a comedian, he's a writer, and former editor of The Onion. And his new book, Funny on Purpose, is coming out in April. And I want to mention he is a native of Penacook, New Hampshire. Any shout-out for New Hampshire there, Joe?
Check out the Hannah Duston Memorial if you get a chance, because it's not going to be around too much longer. I don't think it's crumbling.
Speaking of satire, a link to his op-ed is at wordofmouthradio.org. And our look at the many shades of satire continues with a visit to the Brave New Workshop. That's America's longest-running satirical theater, and it's a company which helped launch the careers of comedy writers and producers, and even U.S. Senator Al Franken, among others. That story, when word of mouth continues, after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Brave New Workshop in Minneapolis has helped launch the careers of a number of writers and producers and humorists working in comedy today, including the notable team of Al Franken and Tom Davis, the first head writers for Saturday Night Live. Franken has since made the jump to politics, but as producer Noel Clark discovered, it's not such a great leap from comedy to current events. Here's Noel's story from America's longest-running satirical comedy theater.
Promiscuous hostility, positive neutrality. This snappy phrase serves as a guidepost for the raucous brand of social satire and political poke-funnery of the Brave New Workshop. The workshop stages 3 to 5 original, cast-written performances each year. In their new space in the downtown Minneapolis Theater District, I get a front-row seat for the occupation.
And we will not stand for it! We are the 99%, and our voices will be heard! Occupy Arden Hills!
Occupy Arden Hills!
Occupy Arden Hills!
Occupy Arden Hills, or Brother, Can You Spare a Dome, is the latest entry in a long line of these sketch-style performances, with titles such as Bushwhacked, One Nation Under Stress, Total Recall 2, The Governator, and Obama Mia, or The Real Housewives of Abbottabad. Given the modern 24-hour news cycle, the shows can change fairly quickly.
The general theory was that we would run it for about 3 months and then we would open something else.
Caleb McEwen, artistic director for the Brave New Workshop, puts this in perspective.
Because it has remained topical or even been more in the news than when we started, we're not doing it. We're continuing to run this show because it still fits.
Loans and they make you frown. You think life's not fair and you don't know why. You gotta occupy.
According to Caleb, the draw of current events to comics and writers lies in the fact that issues require little background or extra exposition. They also live right in the public eye.
Whether the stadium does happen or it doesn't happen, no matter where it is, people are going to be angry. They're going to be angry if it happens, they're going to be angry if it doesn't happen. And the show is set up in such a way that it does not have an outcome that is based in reality. It is, you know, it's kind of a hypothetical situation. So it works either way.
For comedy writers such as Bobby Gardner, who plays the lead role of Noah in Occupy, this is a gold mine.
The days of Walter Cronkite are gone. News nowadays, because we have entire news stations, they need to get ratings just as much as any other channel does. So a lot of it is what's entertaining and what is going to keep people tuning in.
Good evening, I'm Tom Brokaw. While researching the Greatest Generation,
and those are the types of people that we love.
Please join me as I delve into the inner workings of the worst generation. This is Calvin Nash.
Because we can take actual things that they've said and turn it into an entire sketch.
The team behind Occupy Arden Hills aren't just singling out the media. They take jabs at protesters, sports fans, aimless youth, grad students, Republicans, and Democrats. Anyone is fair game.
Wait. That our government should not be able to force us to pay for a dome, or for other people's health care, or take away my assault weapons!
What?
Isn't that right, my Tea Party brothers and sisters? Yeah!
Wait, Talia, you know that this is an Occupy protest, right?
Well, yeah, the Tea Party is occupying the potential stadium site to protest fiscal irresponsibility.
No!
No?
Yes? No, no, they're two different things.
Ugh, I knew we should have been more clear with our signage.
The perception of what we're doing at face value may seem that we're poking fun, but it's kind of the same theme as I can call my kids stupid, but you can't call my kids stupid. Yeah.
For cast members Andy Hillbrands and Josh Eakright, a good portion of the show's jokes actually make fun of issues they believe in. But, as the old saying goes, if you can't laugh at yourself, then who can you laugh at?
I want to echo that. That positive neutrality, promiscuous hostility, I love that we stay true to that as hard as we can, because that was something that was put in place by Dudley Riggs, the founder. And he was so dead on with that.
If the key to satire truly is first make people laugh, then make them think, cast member Taj Ruler would like showgoers to take away one important thing from Occupy Arden Hills or Brother, Can You Spare a Dome?
Minnesota sports teams just need to get their act together, please. That would be great. Except for the Lynx. You guys rock. So I'll just say that. I think that's important.
Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
Millions of people across the globe rallied yesterday for freedom of speech and against the attack on Charlie Hebdo magazine. The satirical magazine was targeted by extremists largely for its irreverent cartoon covers. When we come back, we're going to talk to one of the most admired theorists in the world of comics about how simple cartoon images and techniques work on the brain. And that's in a realm operating far beyond the limits of speech. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Stravinsky Suites to Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, just about every field of art and entertainment has inspired scholarly works and criticism. Comics, not so much. But then there are plenty of people who would consider comics scholarship to be an oxymoron. Comics fans are known to be a passionate and devoted lot who talk a lot to each other, but who may have given up on the idea of explaining what is comics to outsiders. Scott McCloud has. He is author of Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art. Published in 1993, it is one of the seminal volumes for comic book writers and a fascinating guide for anyone interested in the creative process. And Scott McCloud, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So a lot of American kids like you grew up loving comics and the guys in tights. When did you decide it was going to be your profession?
Well, I got into it at the age of 14 because I actually thought I was too old for comics before that. But a friend of mine convinced me to give them a try. And only a year later, at the age of 15, I decided I want to make the things for a living.
Hmm.
All the way through the rest of school, that's what I did.
Well, it is an art form, you point out early in the book, that suffers from low self-esteem. Is that your, was that your goal with Understanding Comics, to get some respect?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, certainly I felt that comics were worthy of respect, not so much for what we had done, but what we could do. Because I think all art forms really are just a blank page. You know, they're potential. And just as great movies occupy a pretty small minority of all the movies made, or great novels, a small minority of all the novels made, it was more important to me to convey the idea that comics were capable of greatness. And I do think they are, and I'm happy to report that in the last 15, 20 years, we've been finally living up to that potential.
Mm. They've been used as an art form for a really long time. You point out to us that there are pre-Columbian murals that were discovered by Cortez in the 16th century. There's the Bayeux Tapestry from the Norman invasion, and Hogarth's The Rake's Progress and The Harlot's Progress. These are historical documents for us. So what do they share as comics?
Well, all of them have this very simple idea that you're telling a story through pictures in sequence. The pictures occupy the different parts of a canvas at the same time. And what the reader does is really quite remarkable. We accept it as a kind of map of time. So as we move from one space to the next, we're moving from one time to the next. And all of these things that you mentioned and other things too, like certain Egyptian wall paintings, they all use that same basic storytelling technique. And it's something that we use today in what we call comics.
You, in the book Understanding Comics, I think wonderfully, for me, who is not somebody who passionately loves comics, but, you know, argued with my brothers and sisters over who got the funnies first on Sundays and, you know, read old classics, illustrated comics and Archies and that kind of thing. But you employ these visual tools that comics allow. And you write about the abstraction of comics, you know, rather than perfectly shaded, just the power of line enables readers to be sucked in. It gives us some kind of entry point. Why does that work? Can you explain that concept?
Well, there are different ways in which cartooning in particular, that way of simplifying the world, can really pull a reader in. One of them is that it's more universal. If you just draw a circle with two dots and a line to represent a face, you're representing every face there's ever been. Except for the occasional pirate with an eye patch, I suppose. And that has a power to it because the reader is then participating in the creation of a character, not just receiving this very detailed information about another. And in some ways, we see our own faces in that. So when you're reading Peanuts or you're watching The Simpsons, in a way, you're inhabiting those characters and seeing them as a part of yourself. And that can be very, very strong, very powerful, as it makes us feel like we're in almost a virtual emotional space.
It's that participation is with the reader that comes through so strongly in understanding comics. Like you point out to us the way that we read images and read into images as they move through the page. We are the silent accomplice. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, we're there alongside the artist creating the comic as we read it. The comic's only half done. They're just lines on paper until we arrive at it. So one of the examples I give is what happens between the panels. You know, there's no motion between those panels until we imagine the motion. So at one point I say in Understanding Comics that to kill a man between panels is to condemn him to 1,000 deaths because every reader is going to imagine a different scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have a one panel with the man being threatened, and in the next panel you just see the scream, you know, sort of over a cityscape. We fill in that gap.
Yeah, and that's a tremendous jump. You have to take a moment to admire the mind's ability to make that jump, to make that connection. And if you look around you, you realize that we make that connection every day. When we see something on a supermarket shelf and we're only seeing just an eighth of what we're looking for, some soda bottle or a box of cereal, we're filling in the rest. We're imagining the whole.
Do you like comics? Do you love them passionately? Do you not understand them? Well, Understanding Comics is the title of a book that's considered a remarkable new Baedeker of the tunes, says Doonesbury writer and artist Gary Trudeau. It's kind of a guide to how to make comics and how to look at them and interpret them as an art form. Well, you spend a lot of time in this book explaining how comics do work on the mind or how the brain participates, like how pictures can evoke sensation and emotional response, you know, the wavy lines rising up off the image of a tipped over garbage can or heat off a coffee cup or dizziness or pain. Why do these representations work on us?
Well, you know, it's funny because what happens is we begin by representing the world somewhat literally. And we see this in the evolution of pictorial languages, too, like Chinese. We just start literally drawing what we see. But gradually, over time, through abstraction, through repetition, they become more like language. There's something between a picture and a word that we see in these abstractions. So, for instance, there are these little sweat beads. Sometimes cartoon characters will have a little sweat bead on their forehead. And we know from experience this means they're nervous, they're upset, they're sweating, right? But gradually, cartoonists would draw that sweat bead further and further from the forehead until it became like just a marker, just a little tiny pictogram that simply indicated nervousness. And now a cartoonist could draw a robot and have that same sweat bead over his forehead,
mm-hmm.
even though he has no skin. There's no such thing as a sweat bead on a robot. But we understand it because now it's drifted into the realm of language.
Mm-hmm. How do you, as a comic artist, know how much to show and how much to just leave to the reader?
Well, it's funny. As a theorist, I'm always trying to, you know, work out these things to my satisfaction and explain them as best I can. But as an artist, when I sit down to actually write and draw a comic, I try to forget all of that and try to channel my own intuition and draw more from the heart.
Comics establish story. You know, there's momentum, there's movement from one action to the next. But yet in this book, you make many references to works of art that are established as great. You know, the static works of art, you know, Marcel Duchamp or Picasso or Munch. Do you want to establish how they operate in the same realm, comics and great works of art, or different realms? I mean, what are you trying to do here?
Well, you know, 20 years ago, I think it was more important to cartoonists this notion of some kind of equivalency, the notion that comics could go toe-to-toe with other art forms that were more established, that had a richer history, at least in the eyes of the cultural elite. I don't think that's as important as it used to be. But I do think that those connections to the broader world of fine art are still important because, frankly, everything is connected. And I think it's wise for us to always be on the lookout for those connections that, yes, this week's Amazing Spider-Man or a graphic novel down at Barnes & Noble may have something meaningful in common with Guernica. It may have something meaningful in common with, you know, an episode of Orange is the New Black or cake decorating. I mean, you know, everything is connected. And what happens is if you look at anything closely enough, eventually you find yourself drilling down to the core from which all human expression and communication comes from. You know, all of these are different aspects of the same human instinct to communicate.
You argue, or maybe I should say demonstrate through your drawings, that comics are one mass media, one form of mass media where you can still hear individual voices. I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, you know, it took me 5 years to do this latest graphic novel of mine that'll be coming out in a few weeks. It's called The Sculptor. And I thought, wow, 5 years is a long time. You know, a movie only takes, say, 2.5 years to put together. But then when I go to a movie, I'm looking at 1,000 names in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not even an exaggeration. I think there are about 1,000 for most movies.
You know, it always takes 2 songs now.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I thought, wow, I got to do this all by myself. I can't control exactly how people interpret it, but I think that this is an art form in which you have more control than almost any other. You're able to be very specific when you want to be, more so than, say, prose. But you can also pull back and allow the reader to participate more through simplicity, through iconography. The short answer is it's really good for control freaks, basically. And I'm one of those, I'll confess.
I want to start with this idea of simplicity because we saw, you know, recently the attack in Paris against journalists and cartoonists specifically from Charlie Hebdo, the magazine there, largely for its content, but its drawn covers were the thing that really provoked people. Somebody was clearly a Muslim kissing an Orthodox Jew and, you know, saying it's stronger than hate with slobbering bits all over it. You know, these really worked on people. These really upset people. How would that work differently than a photograph, say, or a shaded line drawing of the same image?
That's a good question. It's not one that I've considered too much. I mean, exactly why drawn images can sometimes be more inflammatory than realistic images or photographs. But that does seem to be the case. And I think perhaps the cartoonist can organize the perceptions of the world and focus them in a way that in some ways can seem more powerful than someone who's just trying to slavishly imitate the appearance of things.
Mm.
You know, it's funny, there's a cartoonist named Joe Sacco who's a very responsible and hardworking journalist who will go to places like Palestine or Bosnia and visit with and talk to people for months, even years, and then draw very detailed accounts of his visits. And in some ways, his work seems to have more power and more veracity, even though for all we know, he could have made it all up. But somehow there's a real power in that drawn image that says, this is a personal account. I lived this, and now I'm relaying it to you with my own visual voice.
Well, Scott McLeod, I feel like I got schooled today. Thank you.
Thanks, Virginia.
Scott McCloud is author of Zot and Destroy Comics and Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art. It's a graphic novel praised by comics artists and writers from Matt Groening to Gary Trudeau. And he says he's got a new book coming out, The Sculptor. When's it coming out?
The Sculptor should be out on February 3rd. Took me 5 years, and I love it like a baby koala. I hope people enjoy reading it.
Viens, petite fille, dans mon comic strip. Viens faire des bulles, viens faire des...
Whip, des, clip, crack, des, bang,
des,
bop,
et des...
Zip, shabam, pow, blop, whew.
Stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we come back, we're going to talk to the co-hosts and creators of NPR's new show about science and human behavior. It's called Invisibilia, but we'll get a peek after a quick break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This month, NPR is launching a new show that investigates the invisible forces, the ideas and beliefs and assumptions and habits and thoughts that guide human behavior. It's called Invisibilia, and here is a clip from the pilot episode that challenges common assumptions about being blind.
All right, Ms. Spiegel, so I know that sometimes neurology and neuroscience
goes over my head.
Or just sounds like a foreign language that you're not particularly interested in speaking.
Uh-huh.
But
just land the plane for me.
Okay.
What does this mean?
What this work suggests is that you may not actually need eyes to see.
You can listen to Invisibilia on NHPR starting on Sunday, January 18th at 9 o'clock on our Best of Public Radio time slot. And joining us now to talk about the program are the co-creators and hosts of the program, Elise Spiegel and Lulu Miller. Lulu hails from NPR Science Desk and is one of the founding producers of Radiolab, where she worked for 5 years and continues to serve as contributor for the show. Lulu, hello.
Hello.
And Elise Spiegel has worked on NPR Science Desk for 10 years, covering psychology, human behavior, and is one of the founding producers and a current contributor to This American Life. Elise, great to talk with you.
Hi.
So give us the Invisibilia elevator pitch, unless I already did.
You did very well.
Okay.
You did very well.
Can you expand? What's the show about?
So it is about all these invisible forces that are controlling or shaping or influencing your behavior. And each hour we look at a different force. So that may seem a little abstract, but these are sort of very real concrete things that social scientists, psychologists, you know, bench scientists are looking at in a variety of ways. So, for example, our first episode is on thoughts. And the question on that episode is, if a thought passes through my head, and let's say it might be a particularly dark thought, does that have any relation to my inner wishes or desires?
And basically the first show starts off with this guy who has this experience where, you know, he's a perfectly kind of normal guy, and then he sits down and he watches the movie, and immediately after the movie, which is a very violent movie,
he watches City of God.
City of God, right. And all of a sudden he is just inundated with these incredibly dark thoughts, including one that is very disturbing to him, which is the thought that he is going to, or he wants to, murder his wife. And he doesn't know have I had a psychotic break? Am I going to genuinely harm someone? And so we kind of use him as a way of, we look at this man who really needs to understand in a real way how to think about his thoughts. And we use that to look at how psychotherapy has thought about your thoughts and the evolution of that over the last 30 years, hopefully in a way that will allow people to kind of think differently about their own thoughts.
Well, that is my question. I mean, it's deeply psychological. You're both science reporters. So how do you illustrate these kind of ineffable, invisible aspects of human behavior?
Well, I mean, I think the real answer to that is we go to a very extreme example where the stakes are very, very clear. And then we use that to kind of draw people in and allow them to see the kind of dynamics of what's going on. And then
we go to professionals who've been trying to study this for decades.
Yeah.
And often what will happen is that there's not always a clear answer. What we'll sometimes show is that you know, here is one take on it, and here is historically what's been shown to happen, and here's another take. And we try our best to go to people who've dedicated their professional lives to answering those questions.
Yeah. Both of you come from public radio shows that have kind of set a gold standard in some way with for storytelling, you know, as journalism, as sound-rich storytelling, but very different shows. So I'm wondering how what you learned working on This American Life and Radiolab, respectively, is going to come through in this show.
So this is Lulu. I think one of the biggest differences is that in the two shows is that This American Life often starts with a script, and a lot of the edits are done on paper. And Radiolab often starts with a conversation, a completely unscripted conversation that you then cut down and kind of bring tape through. And so we've both been experimenting with both of these forms. So I've been sort of forcing Elise to throw away the script and like just be herself and talk. And she's been forcing me to like maybe try to organize some of my ideas through writing first. And I think the product is somewhere in between. There are moments of unscripted, there are moments of scripted, and it's been a really sort of fun and at times challenging process, actually, to kind of play
integrate
with the two techniques.
Well, now you're in a little bit of a startup, but you've come from these phenomenally successful shows. Does it feel like some invisible, may I say, pressure?
Does it feel like invisible pressure? That's a good question.
I would say...
Are you going to say yes?
I
don't know. I mean, like, for me, this is Elise talking. I don't know. Do I feel like there's pressure? I have to say I kind of just have been focused on, I don't know. Like, I feel like we actually genuinely are having a lot of fun in our show.
Yeah.
And, like, for me, the kind of process is the end. It like in a weird way. So I feel like I'm kind of happy with what we've done, and I feel very proud of the work that we've done, and I hope that people will like it.
And I do think, regardless of craft, like the stories and the people we talk to are there. Sometimes there are ideas that aren't always let out into the light, and that alone, even if there's nothing too fancy production wise, is like that's what I'm really excited about and focused on.
How about for listeners? Are you trying out ideas that would not fit in This American Life or Radiolab, or taking ideas and just giving them the invisibilia treatment, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think we're doing some things that would not go on either of those shows. And we're still very much, you know, in the process of experimenting with it. I mean, we have this season that people are about to hear. And if you listen carefully, you can kind of hear an evolution from the first show to the last show, and you can see us changing, and there are stories on our show that I don't think would end up on either of those shows.
You do have similar voices. You both identified yourself at various different points. Something that you've obviously thought about, because you actually warn us at the top of the pilot.
Yeah.
You know, you say where our voices. So. How are you working with that? You know, no one was clearly forced to put on an English accent or Southern.
Although that's a very good idea. We did dabble
in that, Virginia, but we were advised not to, based on our ability. I think we do identify ourselves from time to time, but then at a certain point, we were like, well, people, does it matter that much? Mm-hmm. Like, it's I think that sometimes it's okay if it just runs over you that there are these two ladies telling you some things, and when it's important to know who's who, we tell you. But we actually got the feedback that from a lot of people that they didn't actually need
care
to know who it was.
It's that Lulis.
Yeah.
Well, you are two ladies, right?
We are
public
two
radio
ladies.
And podcasts have been mostly male-centric in terms of hosts, anyway. And certainly in science journalism, do you guys consider yourself the lady pioneers?
Well, I don't know. I feel like we, as a science journalist, I feel like we have a perspective that I haven't necessarily heard articulated in quite the way that we are articulating it.
I think there is one thing Elise brings after 10 years of reporting on mental health is, I guess, just the sentence that an emotion is a real thing and is a valid thing to talk about, study, and interview people about. And I think, of course, there are other journalists who do that, but I think that's kind of a central quality of the show that you'll notice, that emotions are treated just like any molecule would be treated on a show about chemistry. Like, it's a very real thing.
Elise Beagle and Lulu Miller, hosts of the new NPR show Invisibilia. NHPR is going to be airing the first 6 episodes beginning on January 18th at 9. We've also got a link to their website, which includes clips from upcoming shows, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked with a former Onion editor about the kind of thinking and discussions that went into that fake news source's editorial processes and planning. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think satire has to be funny? What is the difference between satire and provocation and offensiveness? Would Charlie Hebdo's covers and content work here in the U.S., or should they? And have you declared, "Je suis Charlie"? We invite you to the online public square on Facebook and on Twitter to enter into dialogue with other listeners. The best use of word of mouth that I can think of. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more word of mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.